Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And tonight, I'm really honored and really excited to be interviewing Dr. Michael Lenz. If there are topics you want to hear, you want to be interviewed, you know someone you want to hear being interviewed, you have comments on one of the podcasts, please reach out to us at health@joma.org, health@joma.org. We want to hear from you. Dr. Lenz is someone I heard being interviewed on one of my favorite podcasts, Pediatric Meltdown, with Dr. Leah Gugino, talking about fibromyalgia and related disorders. And I hunted him down and begged him to let me interview him. So I'm very excited about this opportunity. And then Dr. Lenz, in turn, interviewed Dr. Beatty Benvogel, who I interviewed on this podcast on brain-gut disorders. Dr. Michael Lenz is board certified in pediatrics and internal medicine, meaning he sees patients from newborns through adulthood. He is practicing and will continue to practice in southeastern Wisconsin and the metro Milwaukee area. This lifetime of experience is especially important in working with those who have fibromyalgia, as these and related conditions often start in childhood but are not recognized until years or even decades later. He is also a diplomat of the Board of Lifestyle Medicine and a diplomat of the Board of Clinical Lipidology. His goal is to weave the best of lifestyle medicine with medical management to help patients, their loved ones, and their doctors learn more about these conditions and live the best life possible. Dr. Lenz graduated from the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and completed his residency at the Virginia Commonwealth University Hospitals in Richmond, Virginia. Dr. Lenz has helped hundreds of patients suffering from fibromyalgia and related problems in children and adults. He is committed to educating, inspiring, and equipping patients to walk through this battle triumphantly. Welcome, Dr. Lenz. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be a part of your show.
I'm really excited. I am a big fan of your podcast, and it's cute because I sent you a guest that you've had on, Dr. Beatty Benvogel. I did a podcast with her, and now you did. So I think that's really cool.
Well, it's great to find guests, and once you get into the podcast world, it's nice to connect with other people who are trying to help patients and their loved ones and their families live better with often challenging problems.
Absolutely. I actually recommended your podcast. I heard a story of a family that's having struggles, and I thought they would best be helped by your podcast, and I literally sent them to you.
Well, thank you very much.
So thank you for all that you're doing. And I want to go right into it. I want to talk first about fibromyalgia, and then I also want to talk about related disorders. I find it fascinating that you don't just talk about fibromyalgia, you talk about actually a wide range of interconnected disorders. So I want to first start with just telling us, what is fibromyalgia, please?
So fibromyalgia is a name for a condition that the symptoms are chronic pain, fatigue, and brain fog. Most people with this have some kind of sleeping problem as part of this. And it's chronic. It's often been going on for months. And similar to the podcast that I just did and that you had done with Dr. Beinvogel, it's really not a diagnosis of exclusion. It's something that we should be thinking about pretty early. It's made by, diagnosis is made by history. Now, I'm both a pediatrician and an internist. And sometimes in the world, when you walk on both areas, both as a pediatrician and an internist, sometimes you recognize that there are great guidelines that are the pediatricians developed, and the adult world is slow to adapt, and then vice versa. There are conditions that are the internal medicine world has been active and involved with and probably has better ways to describe it, but their diagnosis in adults, we use the widespread pain index and the symptom severity score, and to make the diagnosis, that's what I prefer using. In the pediatric mm-hmm. world, there is an older version that they use, but basically it's diffuse body pain in more than one area in the body. And along with that, often are difficulty sleeping and other issues. And kind of we can talk about later are these overlapping pain syndromes. And we can get into that. I could keep going as we apply that to the pediatric world and then transitioning into adulthood.
I want to stop you for a minute because when you talk about fibromyalgia, I was always taught that fibromyalgia had specific tender points and yes. you had to like, there was like a diagram
yes,
and then you had
exactly.
to like add them up. I've never made that diagnosis probably because I can't remember that.
Well, that's the old school way of doing it. And part of the problem is, well, how do you know how many, 4 kilograms of pressure, and you had to have this dolometer, which is a pain measure, and you can push in all these spots. And there are spots on the body where everybody's more tender in these certain areas, and you can pull up a diagram. But it turns out it's not necessarily reliable. And when we do, and more research has been done in adults, men typically will not always test positive. So that's why in the past where you'll see 90%, 80% is women, when you actually look at this and take away those tender points or trigger points, that it's probably closer to 60% women and 40% men. So you have areas where have you had pain, and those are then, where did you have pain in those areas? And I often have to couch that by saying, a lot of people, especially if you've had it for a long time, don't want to admit it's a pain. So I say, where have you had any kind of discomfort, tightness, ache, soreness, not feeling right? Mm-hmm. And then you have that kind of checklist that you go along. And then there's a symptom severity score where it's looking at fatigue, looking at symptoms of brain fog, looking at symptoms of depression, headache, doing that off the top of my head, I have in our system going through that. So you're looking at these overlapping symptoms. So it's pain, and then there's a fatigue, brain fog that's associated with it. And a lot of the pediatrics, they're looking at other, what we call overlapping pain syndromes that go along with it. So once you get to comfortable being around it, it's kind of like making the diagnosis of depression, where you have the PHQ-9 that you can use as a supplement to the diagnosis. Obviously, if you are taking a history and somebody has obvious or high, what we call red flags, and they've unintended weight loss and of 30 pounds and they have diffuse pain, you got to be wondering, well, do you have metastatic cancer, which is not too common in kids, but as you get older into adulthood is something you have to obviously be mindful of. The other thing that often gets confusing is it's often comorbid with other conditions. So when you look at rheumatoid arthritis, which is again, more in adults, about 40% of those with rheumatoid arthritis also have coexisting fibromyalgia. So it's not either or. An older criteria said, well, you had to exclude other problems. And outside of having diffuse, metastatic cancer with diffuse pain, but having a inflammatory condition does not mean you can't also have this coexisting. So these are often overlapping and comorbid.
Right. And there's no specific test to rule it in, correct?
Well, just I would compare it to like diagnosing a migraine. Mm-hmm. I think most people are very comfortable in pediatrics, family practice, even patients in making their own self-diagnosis. So we don't have a test to rule it in a migraine, but we have the best is by that history, right? And it's 90% of a diagnosis is by the history. Another 9% is a physical exam. Mm-hmm. And then the last 1% is any other testing. But most of that is ahead of time is I'm already telling patients if, just simply making a diagnosis of a migraine, rarely does a pediatrician ever need to order an MRI or a head CT. You do a careful history and then you do a good neurologic exam and ahead of time. And so.
Right. But I think that migraines have a very typical presentation. You can have variants of them, but typically you have certain criteria. And what you're describing for fibromyalgia, now that you've removed those magic pressure points or pain points, right? It seems kind of vague to me. I'm doing this on purpose because I know people sure. say fibromyalgia is not real, you know, and I want you to make it clear what it is and that it's real.
Sure. It's 100% real. And often do a podcast in the future. It's just a trash can diagnosis. I'm doing research on a what we used to call fibromyalgia in the 1800s and early 1900s was called neurasthenia. And it fell out of favor because people said, oh, it's just a trash can diagnosis. You don't have any way to, there's no nothing concrete to it. But what made it real, what put it on the map, was the functional MRI, looking at blood flow in the brain. And what they find in the pathognomonic part of that pathology is when they will do things like put pressure on your thumbnail, those with fibromyalgia, and then you look at blood flow in the brain, those with fibromyalgia will have activation of the pain centers in the brain, so to speak. But it's at half the pressure as a neurotypical brain. So they are experiencing pain. The alarm is going off, but it's at a pressure setting that is not causing any harm or injury, but it feels exactly like it would be. And it's not just pain. Often that's part of it. But many people who have this also are ultra sensitive or sensitive to other senses in their body, you know, light, sound, smell, touch. I'll often in the current exam rooms I have now, I have shaded windows on one side. And if I walk in with the bright medical exam room to be able to see rashes carefully, but I can tell if I have somebody who has fibromyalgia, I'll ask if, do you mind if I turn off the lights? And they will say, oh, it's not a big deal, but I'll just turn them off. The lights, there's still lights coming through the shade. And they go, well, actually, thank you. That feels much better because right. just light or noise, sound, smells, all of those are more intense than somebody else. And we know that when you put in a baroreceptor type balloon in the rectum, if somebody with IBS and you put it at a pressure, they will have pressure at or pain at a lower pressure. And when you look at blood flow in the functional MRI, it'll show the same kind of thing. So that's what put it on the map. That's what made it real for, you know, a long time. Over 100 of years, people were struggling and people thought it was just, you know, hysteria, hypochondria. It wasn't a real thing. And going back to early 90s in medical school, I never thought that there was really hypochondria. I always thought there probably was a real answer to these, but we didn't know. It was a mystery. And now when you start to understand and unlocking that with the functional MRI, that technology has really helped us understand. It's not used in diagnosis, it's used in research, but it really has shed that light. And part of, you know, for people who've just read my book, who have been struggling with fibromyalgia for a long time, often I've heard from them that they have tears because they feel so validated because they've always in the medical community are often perceived as their least favorite patient walking into the room because they've seen so many. And then just to hear, oh, this is real. I talked about a podcast earlier in the year that was from Spain where all they did was education. They didn't change any medicine. They did 7 2-hour sessions talking about what fibromyalgia and related issues were and talking about that hypersensitive alarm going off. And that lowered their symptoms by 25%. So just having that awareness is so important. And that's why education is so important. But that's often another big buy-in that has to go on by the patient and the family because they're so afraid. But by the time they've been to all the specialists, they've had often all of these tests, just like in the disorders of the gut-brain interaction. And well, what is the answer? And having something real that's and then real answers and then talking about a multifaceted approach to treatment as well.
Right. I think we also have to have validation from medical professionals as well. I find you to be very unusual.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't know anybody else like you.
well, thank you for that. And I have had patients who I've seen over the years, and I just have a heart of compassion. Right. You know, it's one of those who have said, you know, I've never had patients or never had doctors ask me questions you ask. And part of that is I'll go back to their childhood. And when I can go, well, you know, I was a colicky baby. I remember having stomach pain and going to the nurse's room. Boy, my periods. I had a patient of mine who I've treated with comprehensive care. She's probably in her late 30s or so, and as an example. And she said, until she got better with comprehensive care from me, she never she thought it was completely normal to have extreme pain with her period. She just thought that was just normal. And now she doesn't have the severe dysmenorrhea, but since she could remember probably ovulating after a few months and getting into her cycle in adolescence, she had such severe pain. And then you get the neck pain and the headaches. And often then there's another injury, a car accident, giving birth, something that makes healthy lifestyle even harder, you know, the disruptions of those healthy lifestyles that then can bring out somebody that's more vulnerable. But when people, so I'll ask those questions going back to childhood.
I have an important question for you. How much time do you have with your patients?
So that's a great question. So if I had a, if I have a patient that I know who's coming in for a new patient that's coming in, it'll be about 45 minutes.
Wow.
And that is for a new patient, physical, et cetera. If somebody is, you know, and that's the interesting thing. I know you do straight pediatrics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
short
so
physics.
I think that, so one of the things about pediatrics is it's kind of like urgent care, is that it's great because the problem list is usually one. Oh, they have asthma. Oh, and it's asthma, allergies, eczema, but they're all atopic problems, right? And in internal medicine world, we're used to having people with multiple comorbid conditions. So that's an easier blend for me, but that is a challenge. And quite honestly, I like it when I often go over my lunch period, you know, if somebody at 11:15 and I often will go sometimes longer, or if it's the last patient of the day, I will be going longer. I'm trying to fine tune that. I encourage if somebody's emailing me through the podcast and wants to see me, I'll encourage them. Can you check out the book, or can you listen to some of these podcasts ahead of time so that you're already doing this? Can you do the 2016 criteria, the widespread pain index symptom severity score? Can you do the functional impact questionnaire? And actually, and this is a question, it's so simple. Can you write down your history going back to childhood and take the time? I had a recent patient of mine who is in the medical field who's had this, and she said, it's so validating. And she literally came in with five pages. It's so validating that you actually wanted to hear my story going back to when I was a kid. And I find it, I love biographies. I just got done reading a biography about Leonardo da Vinci. And it's, I love hearing people's stories. And that's, but those, that is a time saver. And I think just having, I probably don't need to spend as much. And then we can say, okay, we're going to come back and then we're going to keep working on this. And here are some things to do. Sometimes it's a somewhat in a, often in the pediatric world, there it isn't as full blown as decades later when you get into the adult world. It might just be migraines, or it just might be a functional abdominal pain, or might just be painful periods or those mixed in. And sometimes it's simply, can you do a simple, as you probably have done, a headache diary? Can you have a simple abdominal pain diary that's not too complicated and do that in a, for a week or two? What's your sleep schedule like? Some of those simple things. But yeah, it more time potentially is needed. And that's like we were saying before we went on, as part of why I wrote the book is I used to have a 2-page handout. And then I had a 20-page handout. And that still wasn't enough. And then I thought, should I write a book? And you put yourself out there. And I thought, well, so it's interesting going back to earlier when you say you're kind of unique. And I thought it was just normal for what I was doing because I've been doing this for a number of years. I'm in a health system right now, and I was at a location by myself with another OB, and they decided to consolidate into a little bit bigger clinic. And so I've been doing this just connecting the dots, recognizing these overlapping central pain sensitivity syndromes, other comorbidities with it. I've always been interested in healthy eating and lifestyle medicine, got into lipidology and all of this. And I'm kind of a lifelong learner. When I was in pre-med, they said, you know, every 7 years, half of what you learn changes. Right. And so I knew that, okay, got to keep on. And then I'd start hearing, learning things through leaders in the field like Dr. Daniel Clough, the University of Michigan, who's done a lot of work with fibromyalgia, and listening at conferences and learning about that. And then you start to just take a close family history because you start hearing, oh, well, I have migraines, mom had IBS, or for fibromyalgia, and you start seeing these pain syndromes. Even in the 1800s, when you're looking back and researching that, they were knew that there was a genetic inherited vulnerability that went along with this. But
wait, I want to go back just a little bit and have you explain when you keep referring to central pain syndromes. We've kind of alluded to the fact that there are so many. Maybe we should just list them, but also explain what is a central pain syndrome. Even though I've done this in other podcasts, I think they're listening to this one now.
So. Okay, yeah, if you're listening. So central pain sensitization syndromes, that has to do with the underlying problem with this that they have in common is the central nervous system, the brain, brainstem, spinal cord, and how they're sensing and reacting. There's these bidirectional components to that, especially in things like chronic abdominal pain syndrome. So that can be functional dyspepsia, irritable bowel syndrome, constipation, diarrhea. You have, you know, irritable bladder, which in the past kind of was called interstitial cystitis, migraines, tension, headaches, chronic neck pain, chronic back pain, kind of chronic pains in general. Those are where the nervous system is much more sensitive. And that's what we know with the functional MRIs, with the different light, sound, smell, all of those. And for whatever reason, often in the beginning, it presents usually as a chronic regional pain in one area. And then it can often spread over time, not to be like a cancer that's taken over your body, but for whatever reason, some people get migraines as their first problem. Some people it's very painful periods. Some people it's abdominal pain. Sometimes it's abdominal pain, and then they go through their puberty and it transforms more into migraines or abdominal migraines, all of those. So those are just naming the more common ones that most people are familiar. I might have off the top of my head left a few of those out. But
right. Well, I'm thinking of all the chronic fatigue.
Okay, so yeah,
hypermobile EDS.
Sure, sure. Lyme. Yeah, so those are so that's
a COVID.
Yeah, so under the when you to me, chronic fatigue syndrome is fibromyalgia. Those are synonyms for the same thing. I think if you look at that, and I use the word fibromyalgia because I think there's more stronger data on that. I think chronic fatigue may emphasize more of the fatigue, but for many people with fibromyalgia, the fatigue is worse than the pain. I did a series talking about Lyme and post-Lyme and chronic Lyme, and really those I think fall under the umbrella as triggers. Looking back to the 1800s, they recognized that influenza, pneumonia, syphilis were all triggers for neurasthenia, which this isn't nothing new under the sun, right? These are
mono's the classic one.
All of these, but whatever it is, it's something that probably is a cytokine release that probably makes a neurotypical person feels achy, soreness. But what happens is the pain goes on, but the turning off of the pain, it doesn't turn off like a normal person, and it persists. And that's just something we observe in those who are more prone. So my feeling is that this is bringing light to the people who've been struggling with chronic fatigue syndrome, but never had an understanding. And now I think they're feeling validated because so many people are having a clear connection to a epidemic and the connection with that. So
right. Now that we're seeing so much from long COVID, that was my first thought, is that now finally, you know, this will be accepted as real because there's a huge volume of this kind of issue right now.
And I would call those our triggers, potential triggers, right? You know, but I would say when you look at the overlapping symptoms of long haul COVID, you're like, well, pain, fatigue, right, brain fog, insomnia. I think those are often are the triggers. Most people recover fine, but some it puts them in a downward spiral and they get stuck there. There is something clear cut that other people universally are getting, right? But when you have a relatively isolated car accident, and often people will have an identified trigger, especially into adulthood. Like, oh, I remember I had that car accident and then I started having that. For some women, it's when they gave birth and they never were able to get the demands of a busy life and disrupted sleep, irregular sleep schedule, not getting to the same exercise schedule, maybe not eating as healthy. And then if you're more genetically susceptible and prone, that can be one of the triggers, for example.
Right. So I'm thinking from the biopsychosocial model, right? The interaction of mental health. And it's always so delicate because one of the biggest issues is people saying it's all in your head.
And that depends on, I guess, where you put where you put the syllable, right? Where does that mean? What does that mean in your head? And in a sense, it's the brain. And it's very, very tricky because it's interesting in a couple of Facebook groups that work with fibromyalgia and related issues. And you'll hear about the gaslighting, a term gaslighting. And what's funny is that you'll hear people like, oh, it's medical gaslighting. And that's referring to doctors who basically say, there's nothing wrong. You're fine. You're hysterical. You need to see a therapist. But when we look at things like rejection sensitive dysphoria, that hypersensitivity, emotional sensitivity, it's not just pain, is to recognize, no, you do have a hypersensitive nervous system.
Rejection sensitive dysphoria?
That's the emotional aspect that people who have ADHD have. It's that emotional sensitivity, being much more sensitive to rejection, either real or perceived by your own thoughts, that you have about criticism or perceived criticism. And so much more sensitive to that. And many people with fibromyalgia also have ADHD, not all, but some, that can be a component. But the point is that—
Ooh, that sounds like medical gaslighting for my— Sorry.
Meaning that is real. We know that. Mm-hmm. Just like if somebody walks in the room and the light is too bright for them. And if I don't turn off the light and say, well, it shouldn't be too bright for you. You have a problem. Like, no, I know that. And so recognizing that your nervous system is shifted to being a little more sensitive in a way.
Right. But what I hear you saying is that it's also the perception that they're being not believed. Am I getting this wrong?
When it comes to
when you say rejection sensitive dysphoria, hypersensitive.
Well, yeah, no, so that's their that something, a neutral comment, they might take it much more sensitive. They might
I'm gonna say that historically people with these problems are not believed.
I'm just saying one component of this. So what I'm saying is that it's real, but just like pressure on the thumbnail, it's not causing your thumb to be injured, but it feels like it.
That's why people cry when you finally believe them and you take their history and you validate them. It is huge. When I said you're so unusual, it's because very unfortunately, in typical medical setup, doctors prefer to have things that they can measure, right? Things that they can see and touch and feel. And these disorders are not that.
Well, what the objective part, and we could say that about depression, but
it's true.
You can do a PHQ-9, and then you can later follow up and recheck their PHQ-9. So that's why I do the widespread pain index, symptom severity score, and then it's called the fibro score. When you combine those numbers, I have the fibromyalgia impact score. And that's when I talk about improving and having people lessen their symptoms and sometimes reverse them, is because you see their score come down. So you're having an objective measure of how they are doing. And it's if anybody hasn't had a chance to look at what the fibromyalgia impact score, it's more than just tell me how fatigued you are and how much pain you have, but it talks about how your functioning is and a lot of really good, helpful symptoms that validates that this is real and that we can measure, but we aren't doing functional MRIs, but we do our best. And it's funny, just in the whole medical world, it's some doctors think today that it's just a made up diagnosis.
Yes,
this isn't real.
Yes, that's like, what I'm trying to say.
This is information we've had out for 20 years with functional MRIs. This is, but unfortunately it takes 17 years for something that's commonly found in literature to be accepted. And unfortunately, it also takes some time. So sometimes it's, and I've gotten some recent referrals where it was like, well, go see Dr. Lenz. It's, they could read my book, they could listen to my podcast, but I don't want to learn about that. It's just too much work. It sounds, and I think sometimes when, I don't know if in the pediatric world, but in sometimes the family practice world where some people go, I'm just going to work urgent care clinics. It's just one problem in and right. out the door. I don't have to deal with all the drama. I think drama adds depth to.
I like it too, but you need time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that we have to be kind to our fellow physicians, right? Who are under pressure to, you know, to make their quota, right? Of patients. It's the reality for so many of us. I like the idea that you have a scale. We should put it in the notes for the show, the scale that you talked about. Just
and
now.
It's not my scale. It's called the Fibromyalgia Impact Questionnaire right. Revised. It's you can search on internet search and find mm-hmm. it. And it's a tool. Again, the Widespread Pain Index, Symptom Severity Score, which is the basically the criteria for diagnosing, but also it's helpful for assessing progress over time. So when they look at research studies on if an intervention improved, they would say, oh, when it got better 25%, they'll be looking at things like the fibromyalgia impact score and show that it's improved. I'm trying to fine tune that because I thought, well, I'll put this information out for my patients and also, you know, for anybody else in the world and it's people across the world listening to it is, well, I cannot take care of all the people in my area who have right. this. If they all came to me and I thought, well, what now I'm trying to find maybe putting on the website, here's some things you can do ahead of time before the visit. Here's some things you can do. But I think just kind of getting the education and if you can have those scores, quite honestly, I've often said to people, if you read my book, listen to my podcast, you're going to know more about this than your doctor. And you're almost going to have to be an advocate mm-hmm. for yourself. And then as I say on the podcast, it's hopefully if you have a neutral physician who isn't terribly antagonistic to this whole idea. They just are ignorant because they haven't had training in this whole area, but they're open to at least learning and at least having that. I think one of the problems is I just had a patient of mine, a pediatric patient. Here's a, if you want to hear an interesting mm-hmm. story, it was a 14-year-old patient or so. He had a injury playing football, knee pain. And the pain spread to multiple areas in his body, diffuse pain. And the injury turned out some wild goose chases. Well, we sort of saw something on the x-ray. Well, maybe there's something on the MRI. Maybe you have bone cancer. So you go down those chases, which doesn't help. Turns out, as most of the time, and you've had patients, it's a wild goose chase. There's mm-hmm. nothing really wrong. They even do, but there's those incidentalomas. And then you see a pain doctor who doesn't do a lot. Then you end up seeing a therapist. Then you see somebody else and they said, well, yeah, I think you might have fibro. Let's just put you on gabapentin 3 times a day. Well, it made him extremely drowsy and brain fog got worse and didn't help. Well, they were at least right in recognizing, oh, gabapentin can help with fibromyalgia. But it's not the, they weren't using it properly. They didn't have the fine art of how to use it and what to do and not getting beyond. And that's because of experience. And so that is a challenge. And that's where I do have a resident that I get to work with once a week, roughly through the internal medicine and pediatric residency program and get a chance to teach them and being around and hope, and we'll plan to continue to do that. And hopefully teaching at least the med peds residency with, doing some education on that so they can help and be aware of that. I know that when he's worked on other rotations, even working in the pediatric rheumatology clinic, he's like, I'm making diagnoses and they aren't managing that very much. They may make the diagnosis but how to manage that, they're kind of left in no man's land.
Right. I want to point out a few things. Kind of like what you do. It's not going to be an interlude. If anybody listens to Dr. Lenz's podcast, he has periods where he interviews and then he pops in and explains. Okay. Right. But first of all, when you mentioned gabapentin, I don't really want to go into like specific medication, sure. But It's that approach that person took is, oh, this must be fibro. Let's give GABA. It's not strep equals amoxil, fibro equals gabapentin, right? It's the biopsychosocial model. It's multidisciplinary approach, right?
Yeah, it's and so there at least was a recognition of there's an issue. Oh, this has a medication that can be used for it. Mm-hmm. And it was a medication that was used, but he only needed it at night to help with sleeping. Mm-hmm. Didn't need it during the day. But that's part of the problem, but also with education and understanding. And it's interesting. It was probably 3-4 years by the time they found me. And it's interesting because it was the psych nurse practitioner who said, you know, you might want to see Dr. Lenz. He wrote this book and he has this podcast. Why don't you check him out? And they came in and like a lot of people may be wondering like, okay, well, what's up? You know, what's the big secret or anything? And there is no big secret. It's that comprehensive approach. And then the dad, the mom, the patient, reading, buying in and having, you know, it's like, I like to say real answers, getting that education and then that comprehensive approach to understanding things and implementing if there is, like I say, trying to blend the best of medical management with lifestyle medicine. And now he's doing a lot better. So, so it's a lot more than just simple pills. And I think that's what makes it harder in the medical model. We like, you know, here's a statin to lower your cholesterol. Here's insulin for your diabetes. Here's take out your appendix. Here's your urinary tract infection. And that's what we do great in the medical world.
Blunt here? That's what pays. That's what the money comes from.
You can see a lot more in urgent care, get people in and out. But it leaves a lot of people frustrated. And it probably in the end, the amount of thousands of dollars that this family paid over 4 years, let alone when you look at the societal costs of when you get into the adult world or miss school, miss educational opportunities because they're not going to school because they're missing is huge. Will we ever get that answer when we are, you know, when their pay is reimbursement is for the latest procedure. And that's just how it is.
We have no control over that. Not you and I anyway. But I think the other thing I wanted to point out that you just illustrated is that it is very easy, especially because of the medical model, for somebody to go from doctor to doctor to doctor, procedure to procedure to procedure, and not get relief.
And I say this on the podcast, every time you get referred to another doctor, your trust in the medical system just drops.
Right.
And you get learned helplessness by default, of course. There's nothing. And I kind of imagine that the average doctor and probably more in the adult world kind of puts their head down, mumbles a couple things, and is probably thinking, what do you think I'm going to do? You've seen all these specialists.
But not just that, but I think when you get to the end of the medical road, or at least the end of the reasonable medical road, there's always more, right? I think that typically you're told it's all in your head, go see a psychiatrist. And I think I really want to dig in that a little bit with you because there is also an increased incidence of depression and anxiety within this patient population, correct?
So it's interesting. There is comorbidity of mental health issues that overlap, but often depression isn't as high as you would think, but it's a very high level of frustration. Higher levels of anxiety, as we talked earlier, higher levels of ADHD that go along, but they're not necessarily truly depressed in the classic sense of things, but there is a hypersense of anxiety and high levels of frustration. And again, teasing out what is the difference, but when you do the functional impact questionnaire, one of the questions is, and a lot of the questions are from 0 to 10, from 0, how not at all, to 10, very depressed, how depressed are you? And many of my patients are not that high. Now there's some people when they're in severe fibro, everything's between 8 and 10, every question, you know, with 10 being the worst you could be. And I think that recognizing that and validating to them, like, wow, so you're not so depressed. You're just really frustrated. Yeah. And don't call me depressed, because there is a difference. And they've been on antidepressants. Many have been on, you know, 5 or 6 SSRIs and all of these, and they don't respond often to them. We have medications like duloxetine and venlafaxine that have some benefit. But when we get into medications, most of them have a partial benefit. So they may have tried higher and higher doses. Maybe the lower medium dose may have worked, but they bailed because they developed a side effect, but they didn't recognize, well, there was a 20% improvement. Your fibromyalgia impact score, which goes from 0 to 100, maybe went from a 70 to a 52. Oh, it got a little bit better. I want to be cured. Yeah. And so sometimes it's, if you don't see, if you can't bring in that partial part, hey, your steps are going up, your exercise. So those are those trying to recognize it's a different paradigm for improvement over time. But often—
I want to go back a little bit before I forget my thought process, just for a minute. I'm also thinking that you may be depressed as a result of your pain, not that the depression is primary, the depression is secondary.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you're extremely frustrated. So, and most people, especially in the adult world, have been tried on antidepressants by as part of their workup and often haven't responded. Some have that it's part of it and there's some partial improvement, but so those are often some overlapping conditions and they go along.
Right. And when you talk about partial improvement, I think that's also a hard sell, because if you think you come in, you have strep, we love strep. You give an antibiotic, it goes away, 5 seconds, you're done. It's amazing. And this kind of disorder doesn't respond to just one thing.
Exactly. And part of that is education. Right. And I think most people, in fact, if being in getting a chance to be invited into the fiber world of people who are advocates and are often living with this, is that if when they were checking out my book and checking out the information, one of the things was, you're not saying you have this quick fix thing, because the people who are, live and breathe this, they know that there's not one quick fix. And a lot of them recognize that there are multiple things that are going on. But that is a buy-in. And one of the chapters in my book is called The Buy-In, is I have to get that from the patient and their family. And a lot of them actually, one of the titles I think from today or last week episode was Chasing the Holy Grail,
right,
is patients don't always want to buy in. I have a patient who is in her late 20s who I'm treating. And I saw her mom 4 or 5 years ago. And her mom had this. I saw her and I said, come back in a couple of weeks. We'll follow up and this and that. And I didn't have a book, didn't have a podcast back then. And she didn't believe me. And I said, oh, your mom. And of course, when you do pediatrics and you see families, for HIPAA and stuff, I'm like, how's any family history of any of this? And kind of play dumb, but you kind of know. It's like, oh yeah, my mom's got fibro and she's got migraines and she's got RLS and these with, but she didn't believe you. So how's she doing? Oh, she's doing worse than she did 4 years ago, but she didn't want to. So that's the dilemma, that not only is it with the medical field not buying it, but often patients. So then here's what ends up happening. Where do these patients go? They are vulnerable to low evidence-based medicine. But like I talked in the episode with the chronic Lyme, at least it's a sympathetic doctor who will take time and listen to your story and offer maybe a solution. But long-term antibiotics, we know in pediatrics, is our lifetime. We are holding on antibiotics in the short term, knowing it's probably going to get better in 4 to 8 hours. Take some Tylenol and Motrin, and here's a script if it doesn't, or for the antibiotic, but get better.
Right. I'm wondering your thoughts about other alternative treatments that might not be harmful, because there is a very high placebo rate.
So, interestingly, as I'm researching neurasthenia, and they had a copper plate that had electricity, and you'd put the other end on different parts of your body, and kind of like a TENS unit, and people would get better. Here's an interesting, you have a case of a child whose having fibromyalgia called neurasthenia. And what their program was, have a one-on-one nurse be in the hospital 24/7 with them. And then do some of these treatments. They might have tried things which encourage a healthier plant-based diet. Like, here's some milk, and just have the milk diet and gradually get them eating more and more. And then it was positive psychology, like, hey, I think you're getting better, aren't you? And you're getting better and you're doing a little more. And hey, let's go outside. Let's go for a walk. So it was like very hand-holding, that coaching, that positive that you can get better. But part of that is that psychology of things. If you read some of the stories in the book, one of them was a people who are often in a very tough social situation, a patient who was working for the family business, and working with dad was very not easy, very stressful. Every time dad walked in, the body would tense up in pain. And I was able to do some things with medical treatment education. We went from severe to moderate. We could never break moderate. Went to intensive outpatient for a week of therapy, half a day. And at the end of the week, the therapist said, there's nothing I can do for you. You need to get a new job. He ended up quitting his job, working for a like FedEx, and didn't have the stress, and his pain levels completely dropped. So there are circumstances where people are in. And that's why when I talk about this, there may be things that isn't so easy. Quit a job that's relatively easy for somebody who was able to do that and change. But sometimes it's a marriage, stress, raising children that are having their own difficulties, doing a job that you literally hate, that you have to sit down all day and you are feeling trapped for financial reasons to have to work at a terrible job that you can't stand and makes you sick even working there. And that's a tough one with that. But if they can get into an ideal situation, call it a placebo, but it's the real pressures of that can getting better. But so going back to the alternative treatments, just in general, I think a lot of people will offer things. I had a patient who was told that he had lead toxicity that needed chelation, despite normal medical field. The regular lab test showed he had perfectly fine Lyme, but there was somebody online he found from California who said, no, that test isn't right. You have to do a special test, kind of like the Lyme world where, oh, that test didn't count. Right. Ours is right. And he spent half of his retirement doing chelation therapy and all of these things. And he didn't buy in. And it's kind of sometimes when you have an elderly person who has been scammed or in the middle of a scam to say, no, you don't have somebody in a prison somewhere that you need to send money, or you didn't win the publisher clearinghouse. You are getting scammed. They don't want to believe it. And I think from the alternative world, there's a lot of money spent. And that's, I think it's preying on people who are desperate.
Right. I mean, not everybody out there is doing that. I think there are people in the alternative world who are compassionate, who are not ripping people off, and who may really help people heal by spending time, you know, and believing in them and validating, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a dearth of people like you out there. So, you know, I try to be more open to that. But it's a really good point that it is a vulnerable population. And I'm sure you've seen that before they come to you, like that patient with Lyme disease.
Yeah, no, and that's part of, yeah, exactly. And so I think there is often is a compassion, and it's ends up being how doctors practiced in the late 1800s and the early 1900s who were living with this, because they didn't really have anything else to offer. And some people got better. You know, you'd think of somebody who would have a case where there was an overworked, stressed out young doctor who said, you need to take a break, you need to rest, you need to eat, you need to get some exercise, you need to get some fresh air. And he got better. So some people did, but it wasn't everybody quickly got better. And at least there's somebody who can offer some hope with that. And sometimes it's the mindset. You know, I think there is that cognitive behavioral therapy. As long as they're bringing that up and trying to coach and encourage them, I think working, I just did an interview with Rose Harwood, who has treated this completely with exercise and probably that awareness back at a time in 1999 when she was diagnosed at age 14, where there was no medications FDA approved for. And there weren't the information on functional MRIs. She was told, basically, lower your expectations for life. You aren't going to be able to do much because you're going to not have an easy life, and just accept that. And go see your primary doctor.
Wow. Can you talk a little bit more about the lifestyle part of what you do? I know we're almost out of time, and it's like a whole podcast in and of itself.
Okay. Well, so, you know, at the core, what are the things you're looking at? Exercise, sleep, diet. Those are at the top of that. And then, of course, recognizing social parts that can influence that. So there are a couple studies looking at a healthy plant-based diet that showed cutting in half the symptoms. Now, just did a DGBI, and if you're not eating a lot of fiber and you have a IBS sensitive, you go from 5 grams to 50 grams of fiber overnight, you're going to have a lot more gas production because your microbiome has not been able to adapt to that higher fiber. But transitioning to that, so I try to get people to work more to less processed food and plant-based. The problem is people who actually have fibromyalgia on average eat half as many fruit and vegetables as the average American, which isn't great to start with. And they're more likely eating calorie dense foods because we know that there is that dopamine hit, that morphine like hit when you're eating processed carbs, when you're eating the cheese and the dairy and the chocolates, that is hitting that morphine part of the brain. So trying to shift to that, recognizing that, which is a challenge because, of course, when you have got fibro and you're many patients don't like to cook and they don't like to shop. And then, and what's worse than cooking and shopping, it's doing the dishes afterwards because you're tired and fatigued. So trying the best to recognize that's one part of it. And if you can say, hey, if you can work towards that, or if their family can help support them with that. The exercise with technology, there's good and bad things with technology, but trying to get an activity counter. One of the things I'll just say, and they're usually pretty available, or somebody's got a used one at home that nobody's using. And I say for a week or two, just do your normal activity, track your steps. And one of the things you'll find with fibromyalgia is that the activity, if you look at your daily steps, it's a roller coaster. They may get 1 or 2,000 steps for people who are struggling, and then feel a little more energy and get 5 or 6,000 steps on one day. And then they overdid it, and then they have to rest, and you're going up and down. And I'll say, hey, okay, you're averaging 3,000, but you're going from 6 to 1. Can you pace yourself and try to do 3,000? And then over time, maybe increase your step count each week by 10%, and gradually, and maybe over 2 or 3 months with that. That's a simple thing with that. Looking at your sleep, paying attention to your sleep, and there are coexisting conditions that are medical conditions, restless leg, periodic limb movement, sleep apnea more often in adults, but sometimes kids can have that as well. And also just simply poor sleep hygiene and having a regular schedule. I'll have my patients just say, can you for 2 weeks, can you keep track of when you go to bed, when you get up, how kind of was your quality of sleep? We can actually do that with apps like Sleep Cycle, where you can put it on the bed and try to be consistent, which is when you have adolescents and middle school kids want to be up later on the weekend. Say, can you try it for 2 weeks? And then when you feel better and you have less migraines, and then I throw in, well, what food appetite do you have? I have a podcast I did on weather-induced abdominal pain. And if, I don't know if you listened to that episode, it was about a year ago.
And I argued with you about that. Remember?
Oh, well,
Well,
my point was, well, you were just saying, does weather cause it? But my point was, being in Wisconsin, he had a month, and in one sense it can, but his was caused because he stopped playing any sports, and being in Wisconsin, he didn't just run out and play, and he was just sitting inside, probably watching TV and video games. And if he needed to be more active, and part of that often is you're in the Northeast ish. Mm-hmm. So, it's colder. So it's and darker earlier. So it's when, who wants to walk outside when it's pitch dark after work, but, and who wants to, well, you know,
The point I'm making is, I'm glad you brought this up because I was determined to make this point that, okay, I get migraines, I exercise regularly, I get them more in bad weather and I exercise just as much. And the reason I'm making this point is because it's very easy when you have a lifestyle approach. I think it's so important. I agree with you so much. I think that it's like sleep, diet, and exercise are the three points of the triangle of health. And it's so much more important when you're struggling with these kind of problems. However, the flip side is you don't want to have the person feel guilty or feel that they have more control than they really have. Does that make sense?
And I think that recognizing that there is a vulnerability.
Right.
And that's where I say that there may be people who are in a social situation that they don't control. They can't control how their spouse treats them, the job they're working, how their children's behavior in life and stress. If you listen to Margaret Mitchell's story, and I had an episode on caregiver fatigue, caring for a sick family member can be devastating, where you can't do those. Now, to your point about the weather, just like there are people who can have no true celiac disease, but they report their gut is worse with wheat. Okay, well, it might be for you. And when you're doing studies, you're trying to look at populations, and then there may be an individual sensitivity to things. And you're like, all right, well, in the book in neurasthenia, one of the treatments they recommended was, go to Hawaii or go somewhere warm, get away from the farthest. And so you're like, well, what do we do? You know, I gotta. But often that's better. I just had a patient who spent a little over a week in Florida, and it was 80 degrees with fibro. And she's like, oh, I felt great.
Right.
I just felt so good. I got outside and there was sun and there was fresh air. And then they come back and we were stuck in winter up here in Wisconsin. And she could just feel it's here. And I didn't ask her about her steps or anything from that standpoint, but it's just. There's when you don't see the sun, there's probably something in the brain that affects you.
Seasonal affective disorder. I've heard that they have these light boxes that you can use. Like, some you can compensate to some degree, but this is the issue I have with wellness movements in general and lifestyle in general, that we shouldn't put it all on the patient, that they should be in charge of their wellness 100%. Like, I think we have to have the compassion that they're already struggling, right? I mean, you do have that. I'm just stating it very clear.
And that's a sensitive thing. Nobody wants to feel like this. They don't want to be living like this. But that's part of that recognition that, your software is working differently. There are different inherited levels of neurotransmitters. And part of when you are doing well, you know, most of the time people can look back in their life and from a standpoint, unless they've been in a very high adverse childhood event experience early in life, and they've been in a continued terrible high stress environment their whole life. But for most people, they've had some breaks and some decent life experiences where they'll look back and they'll say, I felt the best. And it's usually when they were most regularly active. They were eating the best. They were most active. They had an active job. They had all of those things. That's when they felt the best. And then something maybe chinks a little in the armor, and they can and then their steps drop tremendously. But I had a patient of mine who had developed long haul COVID type symptoms longer, but she was and is a triathlete, ultramarathon type runner. And it slowed her down some. And we talked about this, and I said, you're probably more genetically prone to this. If you can, try to do as best you can. And now she's recovered from that, but she knew that. We had that conversation, like, why am I so fatigued? And I obligated and ordered a lot of fatigue panel labs, but I said, I'm pretty sure it's all going to be normal. So I always preface this, like, one of my first podcasts was, it's not my thyroid.
Right. Right. Dr. Bain Vogel also is very good about that. She says, you have the golden hour. You have to set the expectations in the beginning that this is going to be the type of disorder that won't have lab abnormalities that we see, but it's real. So you had that conversation with her. I had that conversation with her. It's really important, right? Because otherwise you go down that whole endless journey of tests.
Yeah, and you get somebody who says, oh, I went to the chiropractor. Can you check me for SIBO? What about this? And I'm like, we already did a bunch of labs. And so it's complicated. And that's why if anybody's listening, it's like, oh, like you've done, hey, consider listening to this. Oh, that's interesting. Well, that's an interesting. Okay. So there's a lot of components to it. There's multi-directional relationships. And when you can help share some of those, when people can start to put them in their best position. And that's why there are sometimes medical conditions that get in the way of following through it with the healthiest lifestyle. But if you can recognize that, and that's probably that cognitive behavior therapy, mm-hmm. what are things that are in your control, and help then encourage them. It's coming from a heart of some of that coaching and SMART goals. What are some SMART goals? You know, those measurable, simple, reachable, timed,
specific, kind of measurable, attainable, relevant, and time dependent.
Yeah.
Time specific.
And so those are trying SMART. To work. For the pediatricians listening, you are the challenge, and maybe why I often didn't go into the adult world was, boy, a lot of these patients have so many other comorbid, and we're trying to do SMART goals for their diabetes, SMART goals for their other conditions that they have. And it can be sometimes exhausting, but I've just developed this interest in this. I do all the other general care with my patients with taking care of all these other conditions. But sometimes who cares about these other conditions if I'm in pain, fatigue, and brain fog and I'm struggling? Well, you know, let me die of a heart attack if I can't get any better from this. At least the calorie dense food makes me feel better for the short term.
Right. And not judging that. I mean, it's really hierarchy of needs, right? Like you can't get to 20 SMART goals. You just can't. I have to thank you so much. We could talk all night and we didn't get to so many of the things that you talk so much about. So I'm going to recommend that everybody listen to your podcast.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And if anybody has any questions, I have my email that if you have, or topics that somebody want me to talk about on the podcast, I appreciate the feedback. It's nice to know there's people out there listening. And again, the podcast is for you if you're struggling with these kind of problems. It's for somebody who wants to help their loved ones or help understand. And then it's for the doctors listening out there mm-hmm. who really go, I do really want to know more about this. I was on a podcast called Pediatric Meltdown talking about this. And
that's how I found you.
Yep. And she was, when she interviewed me, she said, you know, I remember the first time I wrote Prozac for a child. And that's that, okay, I got to take that risk. And sometimes when you start to connect and have that confidence as a doctor, like, oh, well, maybe there is this. And as I say that the fibromyalgia patient or type chronic pain patient is probably the least favorite on most pediatric family practice schedule. But ironically for me, it's actually one of my most favorite, because when you have somebody that is, nobody ever says to me, you're the first person who diagnosed a strep infection.
Right.
I can't believe it. I've been to 5 different doctors for 5 years. Nobody's gotten me better. No, but when you have somebody who's struggling and then they get better, it makes sense. And they feel so much more appreciative. So, well, thank you again for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.